Hi, this is Ryan Briscoe, and you need more front wing.
Hello, friends, and thanks for joining us again for another episode of the More Front Wing podcast. This is co-editor Paul Dalby, keeping the big chair warm this week as Steph is traveling abroad. She'll be back with us next week to wrap up our season, but sitting in with me this evening, it's my pleasure to welcome to the show the radio voice of the Indianapolis 500 and the iZot IndyCar Series, Mike King. Mike, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Sure thing, Paul. Hope you're well.
Mike, we've got a lot to cover this evening, so let's just go ahead and jump on in. We, of course, have the season finale coming up this weekend at Las Vegas, and I can't believe we're already talking about wrapping up the season. It seems like just yesterday we were counting the days until we could get to St. Pete, and now we're ready to bring the season to a close suddenly. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny, Paul, because, you know, a lot of us on the broadcast team were talking about how the first half of the season seemed to last forever, but the second half of the season has flown by, so the second half has really gone quickly.
Well, of course, the big news, we'll start at the top of the list here then. Big news, of course, coming into the finale here is the championship battle with Dario Franchitti, Will Power. Dario comes into the event up by 18 points over Power. What are you looking for? What's going to make the difference in your mind coming into this weekend?
Well, you know, Dario is in position, you know, again, to be able to play a little bit of defense, and Will, you know, has to be purely offensive. You know, Will has to win the pole. He probably has to lead more laps than anyone else and then has to hope to win. But if Dario finishes second to him, he's still going to wind up losing the championship. So, you know, this thing is really right now Dario Franchitti's to lose, and it's amazing, Paul, to think that it took the better part of five races for Will to get back in front and near flawless performance in at least two or three of those races. And then one pit stop undid it all at Kentucky. So it's amazing how this whole thing has turned, not once, but twice. But Dario's so good at winning championships now, I have a difficult time you know, betting against him. I really do. I think Dario's probably going to be the guy celebrating again.
Well, you mentioned the pit stops. Of course, they had the incident in Kentucky with Ana Beatriz and Will Power that really, really changed the entire tide of this. At least the complexion of this race going into it, where it was very close. And in fact, Will had such a dominant car the first 50 laps. You know, we could have been looking at a situation where it could have been very difficult for Dario to catch up. As it is, there was the pit road incident. The 12 team couldn't get Will back out, at least at speed. And now Dario's up by 18 points. We come into Las Vegas, though, and the tides have turned a little bit, where Will had a pit stall that was way back toward the middle of pit lane that kind of got him in a poor position and pitting around some teams he wasn't familiar with, where Dario had pit stall number one. Now we're going to see the roles reversed, where Will will have probably pit stall number one, and Dario, on the heels of qualifying, where was he, about 11th or 12th last weekend?
We're going to see him
much further back in pit lane this week than maybe he's used to.
Well, it will certainly make for some interesting strategy for, you know, the Target Chip Ganassi Racing 10 crew, because you're right, you know, he's going to be, well, let's see, with 34 cars, he'll be about a third down pit lane, you know, it is almost an exact role reversal as what we saw between Dario and Will at Kentucky. You know, what's kind of interesting though, when you think about the situation at Kentucky, Paul, is how strange it is to me. And Davey Hamilton, we talked about this, the two of us during the broadcast, how this was a seemingly easy fix. We just couldn't understand how Will Power's side pod cover couldn't simply be replaced by either a spare cover off of or a cover off of his backup car or one off of the Elio Castroneves car, which had gone out early. And, you know, we asked Tim Cindric about that situation, and we're simply told that they didn't fit. And so, to me, it is very odd that yes, he did suffer a puncture in that side pod when Anna, you know, came out, but just like a nose cone or a damaged, you know, front wing, you know, it seems like that a team, particularly Team Penske, would have been in a position to have been able to fix that problem and gotten Will back out without it literally costing him a championship or potential of costing him a championship. So I'm very surprised still that that here we are almost 2 weeks later and to consider the fact that I thought it would have been as easy as interchanging one part with another, but yet for whatever reason, the parts even from Will's backup car to the other car simply didn't fit. And I think it's a huge mistake on the part of Team Penske not to have interchangeable parts from car to car.
And I'll admit that was news to me when he said that. I never realized that there would ever be an issue with interchangeability between cars. I guess I just always assumed that, you know, a side pod is a side pod, and you know that you see, like you mentioned, the front noses are so easily changed. I mean, those are changed now in less than time it takes to fill up the car.
Yeah, just a routine pit stop. Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
We've seen them change suspension. We've seen them change rear wings, and you know all these parts that basically bolt on and off. And for something that's as fragile and as exposed as a side pod to not be interchangeable in the course of a race, yeah, that struck me as very odd. I was surprised to hear that as well. So, you know, even if they're not compatible between, you know, maybe a Target side pod may not match up with a Penske side pod, but as you said, for a team that is, you know, Roger Penske and his team are always three steps ahead of the rest of the game, for them not to have prepared for that scenario seems very, very strange. I agree.
Yeah, well, you know, Davey even said that, you know, with Brian Reinbold Racing, when they were at Indy during the month of May, and of course he'll be running a car with VRR, and once again this weekend at Las Vegas, he said that they made it a point for the cars to all have interchangeable parts for that very reason. If there was a problem with an engine cowling, or a wing, or a nose, or a side pod, that you could, you know, scavenge parts from other cars, in order to make repairs to this car from car A to car B. And yeah, I just, Tim even said after the race at Kentucky that, you know, that Team Penske had to do a better job of being prepared, for an incident like that. But, you know, like everyone else, I was just shocked that this was an issue. And while yes, it was a considerable gash in that side pod, it never, in my opinion, should have been something that was that costly to this team. Now, yes, it should have been an inconvenience, and yes, it should have been put Willpower in a position where he was going to have to make up a lot of spots, but it should have never relegated Will to a situation where he was not even competitive, and he was 4 or 5 miles an hour off the pace. So the team, you know, once again, you know, just like last year when they had some issues in the pits, and I think Chicagoland is probably the one that everyone remembers. And then, of course, you know, Will, you know, made contact with the wall in the finale at Homestead. But, you know, it just seems like Will can't, and the 12 team just can't get out of the way of themselves in order to win a title. And so it's surprising that when you're talking about a Team Penske operation, but, you know, Paul, this isn't the first time it's happened. I mean, if Will doesn't win this championship, this will be 4 consecutive seasons that Penske has seen a title slip away in one of the last couple of races with 3 different drivers. So this has become more a pattern, a rule than an exception. It really is surprising.
Yeah, not the type of performance you would expect out of a Penske team. That's for certain. And I just thought of another example, talking about these interchangeability. Think back about a year and a half ago to Indianapolis when Tony Kanaan almost missed the race at Indianapolis from crashing 2 times in qualifying weekend. And recall that the Andretti Autosport car, I mean, they built cars out of, what, three or four different cars. I mean, they had side pods from one car and a tub from another car and wings from another car. So, yep. You know, there have been instances where these cars have been mixed and matched. So, you know, you kind of wonder if Tim Cindric meant they weren't compatible or they weren't compatible to Penske standards. it just doesn't seem, it's very odd. So,
well, all we know is you know that they got down to the point where they were trying to pop rivet a piece of metal
mm-hmm.
onto a carbon fiber side pod, and at one point, you know, after they had that paint blow all three or four times, they kind of looked like the Keystone Cops running around out there, and I think it was embarrassing to Tim, you know, to see that team be placed in that situation, and of course. You know, we had one of our peer reporters, Nick Yeoman, it was Michael Young who was standing there watching it all. That's radio. When you've got a television camera documenting all of this and, you know, every fix that you try to throw onto your car in the middle of a championship, you know, just keeps flying off and putting your driver farther and farther back, that's got to be embarrassing after a while, and I'm sure it was. And if the issue comes up, at Las Vegas this weekend, I'm sure they're going to be better prepared to handle it.
I think so. On the target side of this, as you mentioned, Dario really just needs to finish second. The Penske guys really need Will to win, and he needs both of his wingmen following him.
Yep.
If they can finish, if he wins, and you know, you get a second and third out of Elio and Brian Briscoe, then Will can still secure the championship. Given the way Penske has performed on the mile-and-a-half track so this year, I don't, they didn't look real strong at Kentucky. They didn't perform real well at Texas earlier this year. Seems like a pretty tall mountain for that team to climb, wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah, and let's remember, too, that you still have to worry about Scott Dixon if you were the Penske guys. I mean, who's to say that Scott Dixon won't wind up winning this race? You know, just like he did at Homestead last
mm-hmm.
year.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, and it can be Dario following Scott, well, you know, then you've really got a situation for Will. Or if Scott is out in front, you know, Dario can finish, what, third or fourth?
Mm-hmm.
And Will, you know, can wind up second and still not win the championship. So it's, you know, it's difficult. And, you know, that Target Chip Ganassi racing operation, they're just so good. I mean, you know, it's funny. I was talking to Dario earlier, and, you know, he said he was kind of bemoaning the fact that he had led so many laps this year but had not been able to finish in some races. And, you know, he was telling me how upset he was, for example, after the New Hampshire race. And if you think about it, New Hampshire was to Dario kind of what Kentucky was to Will. You know, Dario had an unbelievably good car at New Hampshire and looked like he was going to run away from the field, and what happens, he and Taku get together on a restart and it finishes his day. And, you know, you could draw a lot of parallels between his situation there and what happened with Anna and Will at Kentucky. But, you know, Dario, how can you bet against a guy who has won three straight championships, you know, excluding the year, obviously, in 2008 when he didn't run IndyCar? And it was his teammate who won that one. So I just, whatever it is about Target Chip Ganassi Racing, those guys understand pressure situations. They have been through this so many times, and it's almost become routine for them to do it over and over and over again, whether they have to come from behind, whether they have to hold someone off. Whatever it is, they are just a championship operation, be it Dario or be it Scott Dixon. And, they have an edge when it comes to championship races. And I don't know what it is, but you see it all the time in all levels of sport in many different series, that there are some teams that can handle championship pressure and other teams that fold like a deck of cards under that same pressure. And certainly, Chip Ganassi and Mike Hull, they have their guys thinking that they can't lose. And so, in the end, when it comes to these championships, they rarely do.
And as you mentioned, this will be the fourth year in a row that Ganassi, I mean, if they pull this out this weekend, this will be the fourth year in a row that they've beaten the Penske to the line.
Well, you got to remember that Dario's championship in 2007 came with Andretti Green.
Correct. Right.
So if in fact they win this one, this will be three straight. Well, let's see. No, you're right. It will be four in a row because it will be 2008 for Scott, and then the next three
right.
for Dario. So you're right. It will be four in a row for Target Chip Ganassi Racing. And you know, Paul, when you look at the series right now, I mean, you know, you're swimming in a pool with a lot of talent. I mean, and it's a deep pool. To be that dominant with one driver and one crew, to be that dominant is pretty darn impressive. And you know, what's interesting too is that Dario, if he wins it this year, he will have won the championship the last 2 years, not being the guy that's won the most races. And that is, I think, also equally impressive. Says a lot for his consistency, that's for sure.
And his versatility as well. He
yep.
may not have
yep.
won
yep.
the most, but he's certainly shown he is, you know, you can see it with Will Power, who just destroys the competition on the road and street courses, but you see his struggles on the ovals, whether it's by his own doing or bad luck, which he obviously and certainly had a lot of. But, you know, there's the saying that, you know, the luck is where hard work meets opportunity. And, you know, we have certainly seen Will, for one reason or another, struggle on the oval the last 2 years. And we haven't seen anybody be as consistent across the, you know, the big ovals, the short ovals, the street courses, the road courses, as we've seen from Dario. He's just a master of all types of tracks. And that's what it takes to be a champion in this series now.
Yeah. Well, I really thought that the turning point of the season was going to be, you know, at Toronto when Team Penske, you know, decided that Tim Cindric was going to leave, you know, Elio Castroneves' pit box and go to the 12 and call strategy for Will. And I really thought that was going to be the storyline after Will took the championship lead at Motegi. Yeah, I really did, because I figured Will was going to come into Kentucky. He was going to have a good race and would maintain the championship lead, and then would go in and he and Dario would kind of duke it out at Vegas. But now for him to have to play, you know, come from behind, it looks like, unless something crazy happens, it looks like not even the switch of taking Cindric, you know, away from Elio and having him call the races for Will and for the 12 car, it looks like not even that's going to work. So, you know, after a while, you have to feel like you're a little bit snake bit. And I'm sure, given the way that Will, I don't know if you were still in the media room, in the press room when Will talked to us after the Kentucky race.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
You know, to listen to him and to look at him, he was a guy who was already beat, you know? I mean, he just looked like he had climbed almost to the top of the mountain, and somebody had put their foot in his face and pushed him back down. And he was like, man, we were so close. We were so close. I thought that the luck was changing. I thought we had done all the right things, and now this has happened. So, you know, you just kind of get the feeling that while, yes, he's still in this thing, there's something in the back of his mind saying, you'll let another one get away.
Do you get the sense that, you know, after 4 years, that there's almost a sense for the calm demeanor and the confidence you see in Penske, do you get the sense that there's panic and, you know, certainly a lack of confidence at the Penske side that, you know, can we still do this? We haven't won a championship now since 2006. Do we still have what it takes to get this done?
Well, It's after a while, you've got to start thinking that way. You know, I know that Elio, for example, has gone from saying, next year I win the championship, to hopefully one of us win the championship. You know, Elio has changed his tune dramatically when it comes to talking about the future. And when, you know, I remember talking to him 2-3 years ago. It was always, next year the championship is ours. Next year the championship is mine. He's not talking that way anymore. You know, for him to have seen it go away, for Briscoe to have seen it go away, and now for Will to possibly see it slip through his fingers 2 years in a row, that's just difficult. That's just difficult to come back from. Can they do it? There's no denying that they certainly have the opportunity to win championships. And as long as Team Penske remains Team Penske, they will have the opportunity to win championships. But, you know, I don't see Target Chip Ganassi Racing weakening at all. And that's the problem, is they still have the big trophy, and you're going to have to take it from them. And they've proven that now. It's what seems like every year for the last 5 or 6 years. It always seems to be one of them. I mean, look at Dixon. You know, I think Dixon has finished top three in the championship, what, the last 6 years? Something like that, the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, Scott is always there. And so, you know, Scott could very easily be in Dario's shoes and be looking to win his fourth title. He's got two as it is. But, you know, if Dario can pull this off, you know, Chip at the start of 2012 is going to have a couple of drivers that have won a combined 6 championships. And, man, that is hard to, you know, to get past, and particularly when you're talking about a new car and that team having Honda engines for next season. Boy, I don't see it getting any easier for the competition, that's for sure.
I would agree. Well, let's move on past the championship. Let's talk about the race itself now a little bit. You mentioned earlier that we have a 34-car starting field, the largest field that IndyCar race has had since the 1997 Indianapolis 500. In addition to the 26 regulars, we have entries for Paul Tracy, Davey Hamilton, Jay Howard, Wade Cunningham, Pippa Mann, Buddy Rice, Thomas Schechter, and Ed Carpenter again. At the tail end of that, we know starting in 35th position is going to be Dan Weldon as part of this $5 million GoDaddy challenge.
Yep.
Can Dan Weldon pull off this victory from 34th place and win a fan $2.5 million?
Well, I mean, all common sense tells you no, but then again, all common sense would have told you there was no way that team and Weldon would win the Indy 500. So, you know, with that in mind, I would say, yes, he's got a shot. I got to admit that I'm surprised that the odds makers have given him odds out in Vegas that are as good as they are. They've listed him at 15-1 to win the race. And I was a little surprised that they were giving him odds that were that good. But, you know, everything that I know about racing tells me that it would take the most incredible series of circumstances for Dan to be able to pull this off. And, you know, given that he is going to not only have to start dead last, but he is going to have a very poor pit stall selection. I mean, he's going to be well back. What did he qualify? Well, let's see, he didn't qualify because he failed tech. So what is he going to be, like 27th or 28th on pit lane?
Yeah, somewhere.
You know, so everything, they're going to have to maybe go off strategy or do something that is a little different from everyone else. Maybe hope they can catch some yellows the right way. But, I'm not going to say that it can't happen because, you know, like I said, I would have never thought that Dan was going to win Indy. But, it is certainly improbable. I can say that to think that he could come from 34th and win this thing, that would be some kind of drive, that's for sure.
Well, earlier this week on IndyCar Nation, I had part of an article. My opinion was part of an article that was posted by Zach Houghton from IndyCar Advocate. My opinion was that, very much like yours, it's going to take a Herculean effort to get this done. I think he's going to have a lot of chips fall his way. I think starting that far back, starting 33 guys behind the leader, he's going to be at risk of getting lapped early on. He's going to need some yellow flags early in the race to not only keep him from getting lapped, but also give him the opportunity to pass a lot of cars on the restarts. I think if he can get several early yellow flags that, you know, I certainly don't want to wish for anyone to crash out of the race, but if he can avoid accidents, that you have to assume there are going to be a few accidents in the 34-car field. You know, if he can avoid those, make up positions there, make up positions on the restart, avoid getting lapped early in the race, I think his chances increase the longer he goes into the race. You mentioned the 2008 finale a few minutes ago, where we saw Elio Castroneves come from the back of the field. Started 28th-ish, somewhere 27, 28, 29 cars, if I recall, in that race. And it didn't take him 200 laps to get to the front. As I recall, he was up near the front of the field by halfway in that race. So getting to the front, if you have a good car, can certainly be done. Now, we've seen this car is fast. All indications are that the race at Texas is going to be the most similar track to what we see at Las Vegas. And, of course, Alex Tagliani put this car on the pole at Texas, and in that first race ran in the top four, I think, the entire race, unless he got shuffled back for a pit stop or so. So we know the car itself is fast. We know the team is going to be able to prepare the car well. Dan Weldon is one of the best drivers ever in the IndyCar series when it comes to the mile-and-a-half ovals. So if there's anyone I think that can get it done, I think Dan is someone that can do it. But with 34 cars, there's a lot of guys to get by. There's a lot of potential for accidents. As you mentioned, the pit selection, pit stalls, we've seen how precarious that can be. It may actually be an advantage to him to be so far toward pit end where he can play a little bit more defensive. Where if he comes in late, he's going to be exiting late. He can kind of see things happen in front of him and hopefully take some more evasive action as opposed to if he was in, you know, say, the middle of pit lane where you have guys in front and behind you and probably coming out on both sides of you. Maybe that plays a little bit to his advantage. But I think if the race starts like it did at Kentucky, where we went something like, oh, I don't know, what was it, 50 laps, I think, before we saw a green flag?
We went farther than that. We went something like 70, 78 or 79,
yeah.
I think.
Okay. Yeah. If the race goes that far, I think, before we get a yellow flag, I think it's going to be almost impossible for Dan to make up the ground he needs to get to the front of the field.
Well, the practice session for Dan will tell the story because, you know, let's remember when Elio did it at Chicagoland, Elio had the fastest car in qualifying, but you remember he was penalized, you know, by Brian Barnhart for dropping the left side tires below the white line coming off of turn two, remember? So he was on pole, if I'm not mistaken, and he was penalized and was sent to the back of the field, but we knew he had the fastest car in the field. So, you know, if Dan winds up in practice, you know, if he's middle of the pack or, you know, maybe sixth or seventh, well, yeah, I want to say Katie brought a door if he's the quickest. If he's the quickest in practice, you know, maybe we can expect to see him do a Tony Kanaan at the start of the race and maybe get by 8-10 cars on the very first lap. But if he's not the quickest car in the field, like you said, it's going to be difficult, very, very difficult to make your way past 33 other cars at the front, particularly when you talk about those guys fighting for the championship.
Let's move on to the other race that we'll be looking at this weekend, and that's the Rookie of the Year race here. We've had an incredible rookie season by several rookies. I don't want to shortchange Charlie Kimball and James Jakes and some of the other rookies as well. But what we've seen out of James Hinchcliffe and J.R. Hildebrand, we've seen a tremendous battle coming right down to the wire for Rookie of the Year honors. In this race, Hinchcliffe will go in 6 points ahead of Hildebrand. What's your opinion on who's going to pull out this victory?
Well, history tells me that Panther Racing has a darn good oval set up. We've seen, you know, good things out of Hildebrand. Certainly JR has been much better on ovals than he has on road and street courses when it comes to qualifying. I mean, JR has passed a lot of cars this season on road and street courses because he just hasn't qualified very well. But, you know, he has done a pretty respectable job of qualifying that car closer to the front on ovals, and certainly he almost won the Indianapolis 500, should have won the Indianapolis 500. Hinch, on the other hand, I tell you what, you know, Hinch just gets better and better and better every race. And, you know, to think that James Hinchcliffe could win this championship, as far as the Sunoco Rookie of the Year Award, to think that he could win this thing with one less race, mm-hmm. than JR is really impressive. And for him to go in to this final race with the lead, you know, man, you know, Hinch is, he's a tough guy to get past. And I like the way he has made great strides on ovals, has been really tough, on road and street courses, but I think this one might well come down to the final, you know, lap of the race before we know. Who knows? We might see JR and Hinch battling up there in the top five or six most of the day. I think clearly they both want to win the Rookie of the Year title. This has probably been one of the, I think probably under IndyCar Series sanction, since 96, I think this is the best rookie class that we've had.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you look back at Champ Car and Kart and the USAC days, I'm sure there have been years when you've been loaded with rookie talent, but I think this year's rookie class has been the finest that we've seen in the last 14, 15, 16 years for sure. So I'm not going to be disappointed with either of them, but, you know, for Hinch, Hinch is a better story, simply because he had to do it, not running St. Pete. And I think, you know, the Newman Haas story and the resurgence there is also good too. But same time, I really like the J.R. Hildebrand, American driver with, you know, that classic American Panther racing team. I love that story as well. So either way, you're going to have a great Rookie of the Year, after Las Vegas.
I think so too. Steph and I actually wrote about this in our counterpoint this week on IndyCar Nation. I guess that was last week we wrote about this. And we split ourselves along, Canadian and U.S. lines here. I think Hildebrand has the advantage here, and Steph thinks that Hinch does. I don't think it can be overstated though in the argument for James Hinchcliffe, I don't think it can be overstated how valuable Oriel Servia has been to James Hinchcliffe and how much that veteran leadership on that team has helped the resurgence of Newman Haas and has helped James Hinchcliffe mature just phenomenally well this year compared to what we saw last year in Indy Lights. And we saw him throw away a lot of races last year in Indy Lights. We haven't seen that this year from Hinchcliffe. By and large,
no, you're right.
He's been very solid.
And on the other hand, think about J.R. Hildebrand with no teammate.
Exactly.
And Panther, aside from the two races where Buddy Rice, you know, has been with him. But, you know, it's interesting. They're two very different personalities. You know, I almost think that has suited J.R. better because, you know, J.R. has that confident swagger about himself where it's almost like, hey, just tell me what I need to do and give me the tools to do it and I'll get it done. You know, Hinch, on the other hand, I agree with you. I think he's needed the veteran leadership, you know, the ability to be able to draw some of that from Serbia. And I think he's taken full advantage. I really do.
Yeah. I agree with you that Hildebrand probably does. A little bit in that vein of Sam Hornish Jr. when he was at Panther, where he kind of thrived getting, you know, I don't want to call him, you know, someone who loves the attention, but I think having the focus on his car and they can fully devote that effort to his team. But I also don't think it's necessarily an irony that two of his best races, be it at Indianapolis and the first, what call it 150 laps at Kentucky, were both the races where he had Buddy Rice to as a teammate. And I think that helps, you know, it certainly helps with team setup, with being able to bounce different ideas off of. I think that Panther is not going to be mistaken for one of the great road course teams. As great as they are on ovals, they struggle on the road course, and they've struggled with whether it was J.R. Hildebrand or Dan Weldon or Vitor Mir or Sam Hornish in that car. I think that's where a teammate would have greatly benefited Hildebrand this year. Some, you know, if Hildebrand had somebody of the likes of Oriel Servia helping them on the road courses and helping not only Hildebrand but also the team itself kind of find its path and find its direction on the road course, I think that would have been a huge benefit to that team and to that driver.
Either way, I think both of them are, you know, going to be great drivers for the future of this series. I mean, I see Hinch and JR having some great battles for championships down the road, you know, in a couple of years. When Elio and Dario and maybe TK, you know, when it's time for them to bow out, let's face it, you know, 2-3 years from now, all three of those guys, you know, may be making that decision. You know, we'll just have to wait and see. It's not like they're getting any younger, but on the other hand, Dario seems to be getting better with age. But as the veterans begin to move out, I think that Hinch and Hildebrand, those are two of the guys to look to, you know, for future championships. I really do. And I really hope that they're both able to get their teams back into it. I hope JR is able to stay with Panther and make Panther a championship contender again. And on the flip side of the coin, I hope Hinch is able to do the exact same thing with Doom and Haas. To be able to see those two teams, you know, back in championship contention, season in, season out, race in and race out, racing up in the top five, top six, top seven, I think it can only mean good things for the series.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as you said those team names, it kind of brought to my mind a little bit. These are, when you think of Panther Race and you think of Newman Haas, I mean, these were the flag-bearing teams for the respective series in the early part of the 2000s. You know, before that kind of shift overcame, you know, in 2002, 2003, where Penske and Ganassi came over, it was Panther was the team to shoot for in the IRL, and it was Newman Haas that you were shooting for if you were following the CART series. And, you know, to see those two now going head-to-head for this Rookie of the Year championship, I think hopefully it forebodes well for 2 or 3 years down the line where we could see both of these guys not fighting just for Rookie of the Year championship, but see both of these teams really battling for the IndyCar Series championship. I think to get those two teams back on full strength, to really go toe-to-toe with the Ganassis and the Penskes, it's just going to enhance the series if they can keep these core units together for both of those teams, I think.
And let's remember, Paul, that even though it probably won't translate certainly into these cars or to the new 20-degree banking, you know, let's remember that Newman Haas won the last two IndyCar events that were contested at Las Vegas in 2004 and 2005 with Sebastian Bourdais. So, you know, they are going to take a certain amount of confidence into that facility. I mean, it's been a long time since Panther has run a car at that track, but, you know, at least Newman Haas, there's a couple of guys that are still there that are going to say, oh, yeah, I remember this or I remember that. The track has been reconfigured, but, you know, success at a place is always important. And, you know, Bourdais won both in 2004 and 2005 at Vegas.
That's good. Let me ask you a different question on a new topic here. This is a question I posted on Twitter a few days ago, and I got some interesting responses from some of my followers. Given the build-up for this race, and Randy Barnard and his team have done a tremendous job of building up this event and all of the ancillary events that go along with this race weekend, does 300 miles seem too short for this race for all the build-up and all the different stories we have to go through? Is 300 miles just too short to get all this figured out?
That's a good question. I mean, I've got to admit I haven't thought about it a lot simply because, you know, the last several years, you know, our season finales have all been 300-mile events. So, would I like to see a championship event perhaps, you know, last a little longer? You know, I mean, let's face it, if we don't get a yellow, you know, or maybe just one yellow for just a few laps, this race lasts an hour and 40 minutes, hour and 45 minutes. I wouldn't mind seeing, seeing a 400 miler on a mile and a half. I don't think I'd want to see a 500 mile race on a mile and a half, but I would like to see a three stop race. I think that's the best way to put it. I would like to see the teams absolutely have to do three stops. There's no way strategy wise you could save enough fuel to to do it on two stops. So I would agree with you there that I wouldn't mind seeing a little more racing from that perspective.
And I think we are at 300 laps. I think that is a three-stop race. You're about every 50 to 52, 53 laps, I think, if you go green most of the way. So I think we should see this go three pit stops. And I would just see it go a little
bit. You'd like to think so, but, you know, you think back, you know, the last couple of years, what guys did to save enough fuel to do it on a two-stop strategy, for example, in Kentucky, you know. I mean, there are ways. You know, Elio, it bit him 1 year, and then the next year, you know, he came back and he won the race. So, you know, there are ways to save fuel, to lay back there at the back of the lead pack and draft enough to save enough fuel. I just, you know, like I said, I would like to see it where there's no way, where it's just not humanly possible for you to do it on two stops, even if you get a decent number of yellows. And I guess if that being the case, I would like to see the race extended maybe, you know, a few laps.
Yeah, I want to see them going full out at the end. I don't want to see anyone falling down the banking to cross the start-finish line for a win here.
I agree. I totally agree.
All right, when we throw the checkered flag here, we'll wrap up two milestones in the IndyCar series. It'll be the final time that we see the 2003 Dallara on this in the IndyCar series. It's also going to be the last time for the foreseeable future, I think, that we see Danica Patrick in the IZOT IndyCar series. Let's start with Danica first. You know, she's been given a lot of attention since she came on the scene in 2005. Over the last probably 2, 3, 4 years, the attention has shifted more from, you know, how great she is to the series to, at least from a fan standpoint, how much of a burden she has been toward other drivers and kind of suffocating, you know, their potential growth and their potential popularity. When we look back on the IndyCar career of Danica Patrick, how are we going to remember her?
Oh, boy. You know, I think that 2005 500 will be, at least to some degree, you know, the moment that most people will point to, since she did, you know, make history as the first woman to lead the 500, and she did it in, you know, fairly spectacular fashion. I don't think that the win at Motegi has ever carried the weight with race fans that it probably should, simply because too many people look at that and say, fuel mileage race, and they're just knowledgeable fans do not give fuel mileage wins a lot of merit. I mean, they never have. And so whether or not she won that race, I don't think weighs as heavily when it comes to evaluating her career as perhaps performing the way she performed at Indy, and certainly she had more than that one good performance in 2005. You know, I think we'll probably look back on her career as more a pop icon / personality than as an outstanding driver. It's difficult. I mean, I know Danica well. I think Danica is smart. I think Danica is a good race car driver. I think that it's unfortunate that she goes out the way that she is, because clearly she has not been competitive, certainly the last couple of years, because of the split schedules that she's been running. You know, I mean, this is a driver that, you know, 3 years ago was contending top five in the championship, and really the last 2 years has been as inconsequential as in many respects any other backmarker, simply because she has not been competitive. She has not been a story from the standpoint of a race car driver. And her management team made a decision, you know, to take her to NASCAR and to reap the benefits of that marketing decision, and they've done it in a calculated sort of fashion, and Danica respects that. Danica respects what that has done for her, And I'm, you know, I don't know. I would like to think that at the end of her career, that she looks back and says that her time in IndyCar racing was the most important part of her career because it jettisoned her into this pop stardom that she's experiencing. But certainly if she goes to NASCAR and does not perform in some way, shape, or form, I'm afraid that is going to take away from the accomplishments that she did have in open wheel racing as a competitive driver with a competitive team. So I'm not so sure that her legacy in open wheel racing has really been written yet. I almost think that we have to see what she's going to do in stock car racing first before we really know.
Yeah, I would agree. I think when fans look back on her, like you said, at least for the last couple years, we've seen flashes of her former, you know, aggressive driving self. We saw the finish last year at Homestead with her and Tony Kanaan, where they battled tooth and nail for second place.
Sure.
For 12, 13 laps going toe to toe at the end, you know, among teammates who, although there was no love lost between the teammates at that time, you know, we saw that she can still wield a car. She had a great race at Texas last year. But by and large, like you said, she's been mostly inconsequential. She's got a handful of top tens this year. I don't know if she has any top fives. I'm off the top of my head, maybe. Yeah, I can't think of a top five she's had this year.
I can't remember either. She led a few laps at Indy, but that was kind of a calculated move, you know, because they left her out where, you know, she had to make a late pit stop. So,
yeah.
I don't remember where she finished, but certainly it wasn't top five. But yeah, that's the thing. At the end of the race, over the last couple of years, at the end of the race, with the exception of, like you mentioned, maybe Homestead last year, there have been few times that we have talked to Danica Patrick in the post-race show, because generally we talk to the top five drivers.
Right.
And, you know, after a while, you know, it's strange. I mean, here we are getting ready to say goodbye to Danica, and I don't recall having her. The only time I recall having any sound from her on IndyCar Weekly, for example, this year, was her coming up to congratulate Marco in Victory Lane at Iowa.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, because there has been no overwhelming need to talk to her about anything. And so, you know, I think it's, the sad part about it is that I think had Danica remained focused on open wheel racing, that she would have become a better driver, certainly over the last couple of years, and may have won more races and may have been able to remain competitive. But, you know, when you've got a guy like Dario Franchitti, or when you've got Sam Hornish Jr., or when you've got any number of other drivers, you know, telling you, you cannot do both and be successful at either at the same time. When you've got great drivers telling you that, she's it's going to suffer both ways, and that's what's happened this year, and she's just, you know, continued to go farther down the championship standings. And I don't know, going out with a fizzle, rather than a whimper, rather than a bang, I think is sad for a driver that I thought had a lot of potential, because I got to admit, after 2006 or 2007, I thought to myself, you know what, you know, she's the real deal, and she's going to wind up, you know, contending for a championship. But that never happened.
Do you see her year this year similar to what we saw with Sam Hornish in 2007, where it's just kind of disinterested, just going through the motions? You know that at the end of the year you're going away. You're just trying to get through the year at this point, really.
Yeah, but, you know, the only difference between Danica and Sam is Danica really knows how to play the game. You know, she really knows how to play the marketing game. She really knows how to serve up the sound bites. You know, her marketing team really knows how to steal a moment. I mean, yeah, perfect example for me. And don't get me wrong, I don't think that Danica had anything necessarily to do with the timing of this, but, you know, she is a brand, you know, and she'll tell you that. You know, the Danica brand is what her marketing team markets, and she is simply a cog in the machine. Well, you know, for me to be sitting and watching ESPN, I believe on the Tuesday after Alex Tagliani had won pole for this year's 500, and for Tag to be sitting on the set in Bristol, being ready to be questioned by those guys on SportsCenter, and about an hour earlier, the scroll comes across the bottom of the screen that reports are that Danica Patrick has reached a deal with JR Motorsports to run nationwide full-time or whatever in 2012 with an eye towards the Cup Series and all of that. None of these, ESPN has learned blah, 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 blah. And then for Alex Tagliani to be sitting there, greatest moment of his life as a race car driver, and the first question out of whoever the anchor was for ESPN, what do you think about Danica Patrick leaving IndyCar to go to NASCAR? Instead of asking Tag about, you know, what's it like to be the first Canadian to be on pole for the 500, or what's it like to win the pole for the 500, any of those things, her people stole that moment from Tagliani and from the IndyCar series to put her front forward and to just take that. And I just thought, man, that's just not right. That's just not right. But yet, you know, her people have done that repeatedly this season. They have rolled out some tidbit of news or some unofficial news or some leak, and it's come when whatever is going on in the IndyCar series, something to offset, you know. And it's smart, it's calculated. But I just don't particularly care for that. But they are, you know, Danica is great, and it's why I say she's smart, because she is. Danica is great at knowing how to steal a moment. You know, Danica understood what she was doing at Milwaukee when she pushed Dan Weldon.
Mm-hmm.
Danica understood what she was doing when she got out of her car and started walking down pit lane, and the crowd started going crazy after she and Briscoe got together at Indy. She knew exactly what she was doing. She understood, you know, this is going to be the story, not the guy that wins the 500, me walking down to Penske's pit. I mean, it's brilliant in many respects, but, that still doesn't mean that everyone has to like it.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately for her, I think a lot of her, what a lot of open wheel fans are going to remember, they're going to remember her stomping down the pit lane after running out of fuel on the last lap at Michigan in 06. They're going to remember her stomping down pit lane at Indianapolis, as you said, in 2008.
Yeah, it was 2008 because it was the year Dixon won the race.
That's right, right. Yeah. They're going to remember her getting out of her car last year in Indianapolis and throwing her crew under the bus. You know,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, not my fault. Yeah, you know, some of the stories that I've heard about Danica and how physical, you know, she gets with confronting people. One of these days you'll have to talk to Jacques Lozier about an encounter that he had with Danica, I think, at California Speedway. It's just she's fiery. There's no denying that, but there's a set of rules for Danica, and there's a set of rules for other people in Danica's mind. And that's why it kind of, to me, it was so strange to read the remarks that she made about Brazilian drivers and how patient she was to get to learn, you know, and be patient with other drivers and that sort of thing. And I've always thought, man, she's as intense as any driver I've ever seen. She's as short-tempered as any driver I've ever seen when it comes to dealing with other drivers' mistakes. And I had always kind of respected that, but it's just kind of funny to see how she sees herself. And, it's just the way it is. And you know, yet at the same time, she can be just amazingly charming. You know, I mean, I will say this. You know, I was fortunate enough to host the Andretti Green Racing Hour for XM for a couple of years in 2007 and 2008. And, you know, she, when you get her away from the track on a setup day or something before she has to put on her driver's suit and become Danica Patrick, race car driver, when she's just Danica, she is two completely different people. And I mean completely different. Everything about her changes once the paddock is open for business. I mean, even the expression, I mean, the way she looks changes. And it has always been fascinating to me just, you know, how this button gets turned on and she becomes a different person than the one that I talked to just the day before. It really is something.
Hmm. Yeah, it was interesting when she lashed out against the Brazilian drivers and
Yeah, I mean, you know.
But well, the irony of it is I think she was, the comment, I thought the one she was making about EJ Viso is the irony of this, who, of course, isn't Brazilian in the first place. And at the same time, it's interesting she neglected to mention that, you know, her very first race in a Nizod IndyCar Series event, she crashed out at Homestead, very painfully crashed out, when she went flying through an accident scene and ended up running over another car or hitting another car tire and took a big wallop down there in the turn two wall. And I think she said she knocked herself out the first race. So, you know, patience from a young rookie, maybe not necessarily something that is on her resume as well. So do you think now with Danica being gone, that we will see now the personalities of the other drivers starting to shine, that we'll see more stories about the personalities of, you know, there are a lot of great personalities in the Izod IndyCar Series. You know them. I've met many of them before as well. But I don't think those stories have gotten out to the general public and the race fans as a whole. Do you expect?
Yeah, I do think that you'll see the emergence of more personalities. You know, I think that Will Power is one of the great personalities. You know, Will is, a lot of people don't spend enough time with Will to see how funny this guy is, how off the wall he can be, how irreverent sometimes he can be. I mean, Will is he's a handful sometimes. You know, it's funny because his brother, I think, is an investment banker, and his other brother is a stand-up comedian. You know, we were talking about that not so long ago. I mean, this guy comes from an interesting family, but he is a crazy guy. And you know, I've always liked Will. I think Will is really cool. You know, the thing, Paul, though, that's a little bit strange to me is I think that there's this expectation that with Danica leaving, that another woman has to become Danica, you know? And I think that there have been some people who have tried to force that on Samoa. I think there are some who have tried to say, well, you know, Anna Beatrice will be the next, you know, lady of IndyCar, whatever. I'm not so sure that necessarily needs to be the point of emphasis, you know, a woman has to replace Danica as this personality. Now, there is no denying that Danica has been one of the top personalities in the series along with Elio. But, you know, I just think that this expectation that Anna Beatriz or Simone Di Silvestro or Pippa Mann now, like, fill some sort of female pop icon racer void that is being left by Danica, I don't think that's quite fair.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think to use words that Thomas Jefferson used about Benjamin Franklin many, many, many years ago, I can't be the replacement, I'm merely the successor. Whether you're talking about Pippa Mann or Anna Beatrice or Simone Di Silvestro, you're not going to replace Danica Patrick. You're just not going to. That Danica is a personality and a brand that is not going to be replaced. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of fans looking for role models for their young daughters who are not necessarily impressed by what Danica Patrick has put out as her brand. You know, certainly sex sells, and I think Danica has used that to her advantage. But I think there are a lot of people who want to see women advance in the sport based on their skill. They want to see a woman advance in the sport like Simona VeSilvestro has, where, you know, she lets her steering wheel do the talking in her right foot. She doesn't need to do the poses and the spreads in the ESPN swimsuit magazine. They want to see them interact with the fans like Pippa Mann does, and take time to stop with their daughters and take pictures with their daughters and sign an autograph for them. There are a lot of fans that want to see that woman race car driver become successful in the IZOT IndyCar Series.
Right, and that's why Janet Guthrie, I know in conversations I've had with her, it's why Janet had the problems that she had with Danica, because she just so hated the, you know, the short skirt, go daddy sort of thing, you know, I mean, she just, that was everything that she fought against, you know, when she was trying to break into the sport and be, you know, the first woman given an opportunity, and she just felt like it was dragging that effort backwards. So, but I do think it's the one great story when it comes to, you know, the IZOT IndyCar Series over the last 8 or 10 years, and that's the number of opportunities that women drivers have been given in this series to not just be a part of this level of motorsport, but to excel, to be able to participate unharassed, and to be able to really, you know, show that women can compete with men at this level. And, you know, and certainly for Sarah Fisher's team to win with Ed, a couple of weeks ago at Kentucky, I think because many of us have known Sarah for so long, and, you know, I mean, I remember when Sarah was, you know, just a 19-year-old kid, you know, driving, you know, for Derek Walker. I think that so many of us kind of look at Sarah as like a good friend or a member of the family, that we kind of overlook the historical aspect of Sarah Fisher, female team owner, winning this race. I mean, that's a pretty darn big deal, you know. But yet, Sarah is so much just a part of the IndyCar landscape, and you don't look at her as, hey, who's this woman that owns this team? You know, Sarah is just another racer. And because of that, you know, I appreciate the fact that a woman, a quote-unquote woman owner winning a race wasn't the story. You know, it was her team winning the race with, you know, that first-time team, the first-time driver winning that race. And I thought that, you know, I think that's interesting. You know, if you and I both know that if a woman owner won a race at any division in NASCAR, or certainly at the top division, at the cup level, it would be a story for weeks. If there were three full-time female competitors carrying their helmet bags onto the grid, it would be this huge story. With us, it's just another day at the racetrack anymore. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. I like that about the IndyCar Series.
I would agree, and I think that's why you see NASCAR with these specialized programs to, you know, desperately bring in diversity, whether you talk about gender diversity or racial diversity or other cultural diversity in there. You know, like you said, it is part of the fabric of the IZOT IndyCar Series. And I think that what we allow to naturally happen is what they're forcing upon it. And I think that's probably why it's not taken off there, is because it's not natural. And I think
you're right. I think you're exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, moving on again quickly. The 2003 Dallara comes to an end this weekend. I think there's a lot of people very happy about it. A lot of people are tired of seeing it, but I think a lot of people are overlooking that by and large this has been a very good car. We've seen very good racing. It's done a good job at doing things it was never intended to do, and certainly for longer than it was ever intended to do it. You know, I as much as I'm tired of the car and I'm ready to see it go, I will have, you know, there's some nostalgia there. I like this car. It's not the prettiest car that I've ever seen, especially in a race car trim, but I think it's been a good car, and I think, you know, by and large, I think most of the teams would say for what it was intended to do and what it has been asked to do, it's been a pretty good race car.
Well, I think it's been a great car. I think it will go down as one of the all-time great Indy cars. You know, it's kind of funny. It's difficult for me to really understand fans that look at this car and talk about it being ugly, for example. You know, I don't see it. I think it's a pretty cool looking race car, and I think it looks like an Indy car. I know there are some fans that don't like, you know, the air intake. Yet we're going to have that on the new car. You know, according to Tony Kottmann, it's not going to be called an air intake or air scoop. It's going to be called a turbo inlet. I just think this car has done so many things that DeLauro did so many things right with this car. I think it's offered up great racing. I think that it's done an incredible job protecting drivers. I think back to when the series raced at Las Vegas in 96 and we were saying goodbye to all of the old Lolas and Reynards, you know. And, those were cool race cars. I mean, don't get me wrong. I thought they were cool race cars, but I remember when, you know, because in 97, the G-Forces and the DeLauras were going to be replacing, you know, those cars, the new generation. We were going to normally aspirated engines, the whole nine yards. I remember not being totally, you know, sold on the first generation DeLauro and G-Force. I didn't necessarily, you know, think that was, you know, a great looking race car. I remember thinking when it came along, that when the Riley and Scott car came along, I thought, well, this is a pretty good looking car, you know. But I remember when this DeLauro came out, I remember thinking, I like this car. And, you know, it's, over the years, like I said, there have been, you know, a few updates to it, but I like a car that can do its job and continue to win years later. And to think that what Dan Weldon was driving, what was it, a 2004 or 2005 chassis this year?
2003. It was an original.
Was it a 3? So it was one of the original DeLaurans. I mean, think about that. That's incredible. I mean, that really is incredible. And, you know, it's one of the stories that I don't think that the IndyCar series attempts to tell nearly enough. But the fact that if you look back to what a Penske or a Ganassi or a Newman Haas or anybody else, Patrick or anyone else, what those teams were spending in the early 90s to field a competitive IndyCar team in kart. And now you fast forward almost 20 years, to what we're doing right now, and the fact that the dollars are almost dead equal.
It's
incredible. It's incredible to think that this sport has not only, like you said, not only managed to maintain cost over a 20-year period, but in some cases reduce them and make the competition better. And that being the case, I think it's an incredible story. What other professional sports series in this world can say that? Can say that they have not just kept alive on you know a grasp on their cost, their overall cost for their team, so they're spending the same now as they did 20 years ago, but in some cases you're spending less to be more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. You know, I mean, that really is. So, I do. I think DeLauro's done a great job. I will say this, though. I talked to Dario Franchitti earlier today. You know, Dario, for one, just does not like the new car at all. He just thinks it's ugly. And I mean, you'll be able to listen, you know, maybe to his interview on IndyCar Weekly, him talking about the new car, but he just doesn't understand how they didn't come up with a better looking car, and he is, you know, just now so looking forward to these aero kits, you know, coming out in 2013 because he says, man, anything's got to be better than the way this car looks. So, only thing that he did say, Paul, was it looks better in person than it does in pictures. He said that's the only saving grace is that it looks a little better in person than it does in pictures. But I was a little surprised to hear his comments, but Dario's not one to pull any punches.
I think the thing with the Dallara, I think it gets a bad knock from a lot of the IndyCar detractors about its safety record, but I don't think there are many drivers that have driven this car for the last, 8 years now, that would knock this Dallara in terms of safety. Have we seen some broken backs? Yes, we have. But remember, where we're seeing most of these broken backs are on very, very high-speed ovals, and many times in accidents that 25 years ago, I don't think the drivers would have survived. You look at Will Power's horrific accident at Sonoma 3 years ago. Think of Vitor Mira's savage accident at Indianapolis. Even Bruno Junqueira's accident in 2005, which was in a G-Force at the time, or a Panos, he head-on into the wall at 220, 25 miles an hour. These are accidents that drivers didn't used to walk away from. And now,
think of, what about Kenny Brick's crash at Texas?
Just horrific. Absolutely horrific.
And for Kenny to not just walk away, he didn't walk away from the incident, but he survived it and lived to race another day. That was pretty incredible. It really was. So yeah, I think it's hard to argue that this car, I think that the Justin Wilson incident at Mid-Ohio really kind of set some people back in their seats and said, how in the world did that happen? I think though, Paul, what happened when it came to the Justin Wilson incident, is that a lot of people just don't understand that, this is a guy that's literally crammed into that tub. I mean, here's a guy who's 6'4" and a half, almost 6'5", who is probably 5 or 6 inches taller than the next biggest driver other than his brother, and is sitting in a car, literally with zero padding, almost no seat at all, just to be able to get into the race car. And that's kind of an extenuating circumstance that I'm not sure that everyone takes into consideration when they point at that and say, see, that car is not as safe as it should be. Well, like I said, if that had happened with Dario, if that had happened with Will, if that had happened with TK or EJ or Elio or most other drivers, they would not have suffered, I don't think, the same injury that Justin suffered.
Well, and you look, I don't think the mechanism was greatly different than what happened to Paul Tracy in a DP01 at Long Beach several years ago.
Right. That's right, yep.
It's just that vertical fall, even, whether it's from, 6 inches or 2 feet or whatever the case may be. I'll tell you what, I was on the golf course earlier today on a golf cart that had plenty of padding on the seat, and we hit a bump. And just the way I bounced off the seat, it knocked the wind out of me when I a vertical compression on that. So, it was a freak accident, like you said. And I don't think it certainly isn't indicative of what happened with this car. That accident, I think, could have happened in a lot of cars. And I think they've taken steps to make sure that those, and more credit to Dallara, they've looked at all of these incidents over the last 8 years, and they're doing everything they can to engineer even more safety into this new car to make sure that accidents like that, whether you're talking about EJ Viso at, 5'2" or 5'3", or Justin Wilson at 6'3", that both of those are adequately protected against these types of events. And kudos to Dallara, and I think they're going to make a fantastic car. I think the darkest mark on this car, of course, is going to be the tragedy from Homestead in 2006 where Paul Dana was tragically and fatally injured. That was an incident that no car was going, that had nothing to do with Dallara, and for anyone who would hold that against Dallara and say that, they had an unsafe car in that situation, just doesn't understand what happened there and how racing incidents work. And, with that exception, I would say this has been a car that really has held its own safety-wise in for the amount of races it's run, for the amount of speed that it's run, for the amount of accidents that have happened at those speeds. This is a car that I think holds its own to any other when it comes to safety.
Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, let's just get some wrap-up items here, some quick hitters. Panther Racing finally confirmed, I don't think it was a secret to anyone, but finally confirmed that they'll join Penske and Andretti with Chevrolet engines in 2012, bringing the bow tie back to the Panther guys. I'm excited about this. I think a lot of people are to see an American brand back on the All-American team again. Let's just hope they can recapture some of their glory from the 2002-2003 era and keep going with the success they've seen this year. 2012, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think it was Panther that gave Chevrolet the last win in the series, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So, it's funny, when I saw the press release, I thought that they had already announced it. I thought this was something that we knew weeks ago. So I was surprised to see that it was new news. but I'm happy to see that, I guess, that it was confirmed.
On unconfirmed news, we look forward to hopefully hearing some more news from Lotus here in the next week or two. I think there are at least two teams that are going to be signed up with Lotus, possibly a third. So I look for that news to be coming out here in the next handful of weeks. I doubt if we'll hear it this weekend, but I think looks like those contracts are finally starting to fall into place, and we're going to see a couple teams there with Lotus. So hopefully Lotus will be able to catch up with Honda and Chevrolet and put a competitive effort together before we get to St. Pete next year.
That would be nice. You know, my only fear, Paul, is, you know, I remember all too well, you know, what it was like the last time we had engine competition, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, the problem is that people have sometimes very short memories, and you know, Honda kicked Toyota and Chevrolet to the curb and just let them sit there, and I remember week after week after week hearing drivers that had Chevys and Toyotas basically scream, well, we were first in class, well, we don't have a chance, well, you know, something's got to happen, something's got to change, these guys are, you know, they're untouchable, you know, talking about the Hondas. So, and I mean, let's face it, if you look at Scott Dixon, for example, if you look at his record, I think in 2004 and 2005, Scott couldn't buy a win, you know, because they were a Toyota team. I only hope that that all three engine manufacturers are stout, you know, because I do hope that the turbochargers do make a difference. That if there is one one engine with a decided advantage, that there is a way through either the turbo and computer adjustments to the engines that some changes can be made to equalize it. But at the same time, I think to myself, well, you know, that's not fair. You know, that's not fair if you are taking something away from an engine manufacturer who has done a better job, or giving more to another manufacturer who isn't as competitive. That's not fair. But yet, that's what has to happen in order to keep the competition, at least fair to some degree, and all the teams happy. So, like I said, you know, there are some folks out there that have some pretty short memories, and I do recall, you know, what it was like, and I just hope that Chevy and Lotus come loaded for bear, because if they're not, they're going to suffer the same fate that Chevy and Toyota suffered back in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, complacency certainly leads to a bit of revisionist history sometimes.
Absolutely.
Speaking of 2012, we're expecting the schedule to be released, this weekend. I think I saw the 14th was the date. We're expecting that to be released. Oval fans probably not going to be very happy about next year's schedule.
No, I don't think so. I think we'll probably see maybe a maximum of five, but you know, by the same token, if you can't get fans to show up for oval events, with the exception of a precious few events that just seem to be able to get the job done, and those, you know, fans at places like, for example, Iowa, certainly Indy, or at Texas, for example, I'm still not real sure what we should expect out of a place like California, you know, where we've never drawn well historically. I remember, you know, those races. Hopefully that's going to change, but we'll just have to wait and see. But then on the other hand, you look at the success of venues, you know, I mean, Baltimore has now become kind of the gold standard for street course events, it seems. But you know, Long Beach is wonderful. St. Pete is great. Toronto is coming back, and they're doing a better job, and the crowd is getting to that more and more. But, you know, Baltimore is just blow away. And if that's where promoters are going to make money, that's where you have to run events. And it's a real conundrum, but it's one you've got to deal with.
Well, it'll be interesting to see this weekend what sort of attendance and crowd we get at Las Vegas, and we have to wonder if maybe that isn't a model that IndyCar, if this is a success, if IndyCar may not start to look at doing a bit more self-promotion at some of these events, whether you look at a Michigan or, you know, some of the other ovals that fans are clamoring, Phoenix, some of these other ovals where fans really want to get back to, but where the promoters are a little bit leery because, you know, it's tough to draw the crowd. They want to focus on their NASCAR race, you know, attendance and bring those numbers back up. So, you know, IndyCar gets treated like the redheaded stepchild, very little help, like we saw, you know, last year at Chicagoland, for instance. You know, if IndyCar proves that they can promote its own event well this weekend, maybe that opens up a little bit of the playbook in the coming years. But I don't think that Randy Bernard and certainly the Indianapolis Motor Speedway corporate board doesn't want to be in the business of losing money on promoting events. So it's going to have to be a real success this weekend. And you got to find money somewhere, whether it's from sponsors, whether it's from, you know, something from the Las Vegas Visitors and Convention Bureau, from TV rights, whatever it is, however they get money. They're going to need to find some way to make this so IndyCar isn't footing the entire bill.
Yeah, I certainly hope we see a big crowd. It is an interesting model, you know, to be able to essentially have an event where it's supported, you know, with the large ticket giveaway for those, you know, fans that have attended other IndyCar series events and all of the peripheral events that are a part of the Vegas celebration. The only thing that will determine, obviously, at this point, if it's going to be successful, is how it's received by fans. And, you know, we all know that you know, doing this when you have to compete for those eyes on your event with the NFL is so difficult to do. So this is a test for sure, and there's been no shortage in effort, I can tell you that. So it will be interesting to see how this event is received. And given that we're on the West Coast, at close proximity to the West Coast, and that there has not been an oval event where IndyCar fans on the West Coast have been able to drive to one. I mean, they, you know, they've had road and street courses that they could attend, but this is the closest oval that they can see. IndyCars run at 215, 218 miles an hour. Yeah, everything should play into your favor. It should say that you're going to have a great crowd. And you know, let's hope that's the case.
Off the track, and certainly saying congratulations to Tony Kanaan of Vitor Mira, who finished their Ironman triathlon last weekend in Hawaii under 13 hours. Tell you what, Mike. A whole marathon, 112 miles on a bike, and 2.5 miles in the water, in backwards order of what I just said. I think I might still be in the ocean trying to swim the 2.5 miles.
I'd have gotten about a mile and a half, and then you'd had to have called out a team of divers to retrieve my lifeless body. It's really pretty incredible. I mean, when you look at it tells you something, though, about both TK and Vitor. I mean, any of those things to do that says you're a great athlete, but to do all three on the same day inside of 13 hours. And it's incredible to think, what were they separated by, like 18 or 20 minutes at the finish?
Something in that ballpark.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were almost, you know, very close to having identical time. So it says a lot about the athletic ability of those two guys. And only a total of like 1,900 people from around the world competing in this, and two of them are IndyCar drivers. I just thought it was astounding.
I want to say, I think I saw Vitor maybe finish like 145th in his age category. So that's nothing to sneeze at, that's for sure.
That's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
Speaking of impressive and athletes and what they can do with their bodies, Elio Castroneves last week in ESPN The Magazine, speaking after what we spoke about earlier about taking your clothes off, Elio was part of this, group of athletes, I guess you call them, from all very different types of sports, from tennis, from gymnastics. I mean, it was the whole range of different athletes that posed nude, I guess you would say, in various positions and kind of showing off their athletic bodies. And so look for Elio in that magazine if you're those sorts of things. I flipped through it in the break room of my office, and there are some incredible athletic bodies in that magazine. Some from football.
I asked Elio, Paul. He was on with me last week on IndyCar Weekly, and I asked him. I said, you expect a lot of these magazines to show up at the autograph session at Vegas? And he looked at me and he smiled and he goes, you know, I didn't think of that. And I said, how many of you think will show up here at Indy next year? And it was kind of funny talking to him about it. And he even said, you know, I had no idea that I was going to be totally naked. He said, I thought when he said that they would Photoshop something and I'd keep my underwear on or something. He goes, no, that's not the case.
That's the sort of thing that would end up in a Team Penske prank somehow, some way. Will Power will, I could see him coming up with something to do with, make sure people see that around the track.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's been some creative use of that picture in and around the Team Penske transporters and shop for sure.
Yeah. And on a final note, on a more serious note, we at More Front Wing certainly continue to send our thoughts and prayers to the family of Michael Wanzer, son of Barry Wanzer at Target Chip Ganassi Racing, who is continuing to fight an incredibly brave fight. And IndyCar will honor him a little bit this weekend with a Get Well Iron Man Michael logo in the grass at Las Vegas. And for those that don't know Mike's story, we would encourage you to seek out his website. That's a caringbridge.org website that's been posted on various social media sites probably on the IndyCar website as well somewhere. It's an inspiring story and one that we certainly send our best wishes to Michael and the entire family in these tough days for them. So our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, Dario and I, we talked about that earlier today, and you can tell just how it affects Dario talking about Michael. And he said he visited him a couple of days ago, and he said it's very, very sad, the fact that, you know, things are getting worse and not better, and that it's a fairly ominous situation right now. But he said, you know, the strength of that kid, he said it's hard to believe that this is a six-year-old kid. And he also said the entire family, the way that you know, they're kind of meeting head on the inevitability of the outcome of this is pretty astounding. But he said it's tough. You know, Dario probably put it best when he said, you know, he goes, it's a six-year-old kid. He said, and when it comes to Michael Wanzer, he goes, life is not fair. And, and he's right, and he's absolutely right. And it's just a very sad situation.
And with that, I hate to end it on a down note, but anyone who's read the story knows that that is an inspiring story. So we will leave it there. Mike King, IMS Radio Network, we thank you so much for taking some time. We've gone quite a bit longer than I think we had anticipated tonight, but I certainly enjoyed the conversation, and thank you greatly for coming on with us.
Sure thing, Paul. Anytime. Appreciate it.
Well, we'll look forward to this weekend at Las Vegas, and we'll be back. Steph will be back in the big chair next week to wrap up our season finale as we wrap up the 2012 IZOD IndyCar Series, and then we'll we'll work into the winter with our winter interview series again. So until next time, I'm Paul Dalby, co-editor at morefrontwing.com. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the I Thought IndyCar series and beyond.